It is Monday, December the 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us. Coming up, Iraqi troops virtually take back Ramadi from Islamic State fighters.
That will also boost the morale of the Iraqi forces and will enable them to make a very strong push towards the second largest city of Iraq.
Also ahead, Iran's leader on the record, that is, about IS and quite a bit more, hunger in Africa, plus looking ahead to the new year. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Iraqi military commanders say they have gained control of the main government compound in the contested city of Ramadi and that engineers were still clearing the site of explosive devices left behind by the fleeing Islamic State fighters. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Arab and Islamic scholar Amin Saikal of Australian National University for his read on what's happening in Ramadi.
Well, I think it is a major loss for the Islamic State and certainly an important gain for the Iraqi forces as well as the U.S.-led international coalition, which has been providing a lot of air support to the Iraqi forces.
Our reports indicate that the Shia militia were not used in this offensive, that in fact Sunni tribesmen were part of the process, and that was a relief to the population.
Well, I think the Sunni tribes were involved in this operation, but at the same time, the Iraqi forces are very much made up of the Shias, and there are elements of the Shia militias involved in the Iraqi armed forces. So I think one cannot really say that this is an entirely Sunni-dominated operation against the Islamic State. It is, while it has received some support from the Sunni tribes, it is very much a Shia-dominated operation.
Well, this operation took a long time. I mean, they encircled the city several weeks ago in mid-November.
Yeah, and it's not the end of the story yet. I mean, it is very possible that the Islamic State may launch a counterattack. And also, as far as the latest news is concerned, there is still fighting going on around Ramadi. So I don't think that the Iraqi armed forces can declare full victory at this point. But of course, they are very close to achieving victory.
Despite the fall of Tikrit to Iraqi forces earlier this year, this is being considered the biggest victory in 18 months since Islamic State made its presence known in Iraq.
Well, that is absolutely true. And, of course, that will also boost the morale of the Iraqi forces and will enable them in cooperation with the Kurdish militia Peshmerga to make a very strong push towards the second-largest city of Iraq, that's Mosul, which has been under the control of the Islamic State since June last year.
Is this a political victory for Haider al-Abadi, the prime minister?
Well, it is a victory of a kind, but of course one must not really forget that Mr. al-Abadi had promised last year that they were going to take over Ramadi within a very short space of time. Within days and weeks, but of course that never really materialized. And it's taken them almost a year to make a thrust into Ramadi, and that does not necessarily mean that they're going to have a sort of a similar easy victory in relation to Mosul.
What does this all mean for the Islamic State? Has it reached its peak, or is it still a major menace that is spreading?
Well, it is still a source of important menace for the region as well as beyond the region. And also it shows that the Islamic State is contained. It has not really achieved any major territorial victory in the last several months, and they're also losing grounds to some extent in Syria, and they have lost some strategic points. But that does not necessarily mean that this is the end of the Islamic State. I think there is still the Islamic State has the potential to put up a very strong resistance, and therefore the risk of more casualties and bloodshed are still there.
Amin Saikal is a professor of political science and director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies. That's at Australian National University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beattie.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Also in the news, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has condemned some Muslim countries over striking the Shiites in Yemen and arming extremists in Iraq and Syria. Rouhani asked, does undermining Syria benefit the Muslim world? Does weakening Syria benefit the Muslim neighbors? Does the destruction of Syria lead to the strengthening of other countries in the region? He was addressing the opening ceremony of the 29th International Islamic Unity Conference that was going on in Tehran. Now let's go to the social media to see what people are saying about Mr. Rouhani's Sunday comments. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here with all the information.
Hi, Steve. Sure, Rouhani called on Muslim countries to unite and work towards improving the image of Islam. He was speaking at an international conference in capital Tehran and criticized the divisions and violence in the Muslim world. This is what he said. We must remove Islam's negative image from today's cyber and real space. There is neither a Shiite nor a Sunni crescent. We have one Islamic moon.
You know, that seems like a pretty moderate remark coming from him. Why are people talking about it?
Well, he added much more scathing remarks later on. The controversy came when he took jabs at Saudi Arabia for purchasing arms from the U.S. and argued Israel is quote-unquote pleased about the ongoing crisis in Syria. Rouhani asked, does the weakening of Syria benefit its Muslim neighbors? Does the destruction of Syria lead to the strengthening of Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, or other countries? Who is pleased by Syria's destruction other than Israel? American TV station CBS posted a video of him making the remarks on Facebook, so let's check out one of the comments. The most popular comment is one that argues against Rouhani. It reads like this. It is benefiting Iran. As the situation worsens in Syria, Iran is taking advantage of that without any contribution. Trying to get closer to Russia. More turmoil in Syria means Iran will have more access to Syria psychologically.
I understand, G. Let's also check out how people are reacting on non-American media outlets.
Sure, I went to check out what people are saying on Reuters India's Facebook post, and it seems like readers are sharing similar sentiments there as well. Here's the most popular reply. Remove Islam's negative image? Then remove the Quran, Hadith, and Surah, etc., or totally rewrite them. That's referring to the holy books in Islam, so as you can see, there is definitely a case for improving the image of Islam in many parts of the world. Steve?
And many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G. on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well. My handle is at VOA Norman. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palkov.
I'm Victor Beattie.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a Sunday attack in northeastern Kenya that killed at least two police officers, also wounded two others. The attack on a military convoy occurred as it left the town of Al-Waq, bound for Mandera near the Somali border. International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda will be closing its doors by month's end. The tribunal, established by the UN Security Council back in 1994 after the genocide in which Hutu militants killed some 800,000 Tutsis and politically moderate Hutus, has indicted 93 people, eight of whom remain at large, convicted 61 and acquitted 14. The Rwanda Tribunal paved the way for the establishment of the International Criminal Court, also called the ICC, in The Hague. At least seven people were killed Sunday as the Nigerian army repelled another Boko Haram attack that happened in Borno State, the capital, Maiduguri. Soldiers reportedly stopped suspected insurgent fighters in the village of Aldawari on the outskirts of the capital city. There were explosions, gunfire punctuating the night. Village homes were set on fire. Sunni insurgency now has killed 20,000 people in the last 6 years and driven millions from their homes. Voters in the Central African Republic are expected to return to the polls on Wednesday in national elections designed to complete a return to the democratic rule since the overthrow of the government in 2013 by the Muslim Salika Alliance. Voters overwhelmingly approved constitutional reforms on December 13th that included term limits on the president and creation of a Senate. The vote has been twice delayed, once from October over sectarian violence, and the second time on Sunday with the inability to distribute ballot papers on time.
Je suis convaincu que les Centrafricains vivront ensemble comme par le passé.
University of Bangui law professor Richard Owanga says he is certain the people of the Central African Republic will live together again, saying only one group, a reference to what he calls troublemakers who kill with impunity. Thousands have died in the sectarian violence that followed the 2013 coup, and 1 million people have fled their homes. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is holding talks today among rival Burundian factions in a bid to end months of political violence that has killed hundreds and forced tens of thousands from their homes. A government delegation is taking part in talks with members of the opposition and civil society in Entebbe, outside of the capital, Kampala. Burundian Foreign Minister Alain Inyamitwe says that spoke with VOA.
We believe that this is the time for us to resume the talks from where they stopped and allow all the political stakeholders, who I believe and everybody should know will have to be peaceful stakeholders, as has been recommended and sealed by the Security Council, which, if you remember, has come up with a resolution calling the government and all interested peaceful stakeholders to resume dialogue.
Unrest in Burundi was sparked by the decision in April by President Pierre Nkurunziza to seek a controversial third term in office, a move critics say violates the country's constitution and the Arusha Agreement ending civil war. 54-member African Union has approved a 5,000-strong peacekeeping force to be deployed in Burundi, a move opposed by the government in Bujumbura. AU insists it has no agenda other than to assist the government and the people of Burundi in their hour of need. United Nations Children's Fund warns poor rainfall and the El Nino weather phenomenon are putting hundreds of thousands of children at risk of hunger and disease in parts of eastern and southern Africa. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the UN in Geneva.
Some countries in eastern and southern Africa have endured two seasons of poor or non-existent rainfall. This situation is being exacerbated by a strong El Nino, a warming weather phenomenon that is expected to peak in the first few months of the new year. The UN Children's Fund reports the well-being of hundreds of thousands of children already suffering from food shortages is likely to worsen under these conditions. For example, it notes more than 10 million people in Ethiopia are going hungry, and this number is likely to increase to 15 million in 2016. It says 350,000 children could need treatment for severe acute malnutrition next year. UNICEF reports food emergencies are affecting around 855,000 people in Somalia, and the number of people currently short of food in Zimbabwe is expected to triple between January and March to 1.5 million. The UN agency says it is particularly concerned about high levels of malnutrition among young children in Malawi. Spokesman Christoph Bujarak says UNICEF is carrying out a mass screening for malnutrition in children under 5 across 90% of the country.
We fear hunger in Malawi, where almost half of the children are already undernourished, because Malawi struggles to cope with drought and with the first maize deficit in a decade.
UNICEF estimates nearly 4% of Malawian children under 5 suffer from severe acute malnutrition, a fatal condition for young children. The agency says its screening program is designed to ferret out vulnerable children so they can be given life-saving therapeutic treatment before it is too late. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, the end of the year holiday season is quite busy for most of us, but there is one place that's very quiet. That's the halls of the U.S. Congress. International Edition's Jim Stevenson speaks with VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman, who tells us it is very quiet on Capitol Hill.
I haven't even bothered to go to the VOA booth over at the Senate. I've been cloistered away in the VOA newsroom. But it is a time to be thinking about the next year and how Congress might function, the various pieces of legislation that might come up, and how the presidential election might impact it all.
All these things certainly looming as we look ahead to 2016. Let's begin with some things that Congress will be faced with upon their return.
They are going to be looking at a big trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and there will eventually be a vote on that. And because last year they passed what's known as trade promotion authority, that means that both chambers will be voting up or down, yes or no, and simple majority votes will get the legislation approved. You can imagine the battle lines that are going to be drawn with labor unions and environmentalists on one side and America's business community on the other. Smart Money says that it will squeak by, but that is really not assured. There are actually some elements of the deal that Republicans who are normally supportive of free trade object to.
Especially when you're talking about up or down votes, these things can get quite interesting.
Indeed. And the fact that it will be happening in a presidential election year always means that it's a wild card. You also have to realize that at least on the Senate side, Republicans secured their majority just in 2014, they want to defend that majority. But most of the contested seats are Republican-held seats, and a lot of those seats are in what are known as purple to bluish states, states where the voters might well elect another Republican or could swing control of those seats back to the Democrats. And if the Democrats pick up 4 seats, then they retake control of the Senate.
Another big issue, at least in terms of foreign policy, that we've seen crop up in 2015 is the threat of terrorism and how the United States wants to handle the battle against Islamic State. And certainly members of Congress are going to be looking at that pretty closely as well.
I would imagine so. And it's sort of a multi-layered thing. There will be those who want a more muscular U.S. military response out in the field, out in the Middle East, over the skies of Syria, over the skies of Iraq, and perhaps with U.S. ground troops in some capacity actually taking part in-ground operations. Then you have those who are more focused on the domestic side, who say that, well, we can't control what happens in the Middle East, but we need to make sure that appropriate domestic security measures are taken. And among the Democrats, what you're hearing is this is really the time to strengthen and beef up our gun control laws. And in particular, the requirements that people who are about to purchase firearms have to go through. It's been pointed out that there are people who are on the no-fly list, who are barred from flying domestically in the United States, who nevertheless could go to a gun show and buy a semi-automatic weapon without so much as a background check.
That is VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with my colleague Jim Stevenson. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Americans throw away about 25 million extruded polystyrene foam or styrofoam cups each year. Unfortunately, polystyrene waste makes up a major portion of the countless tons of plastic debris in the ocean and in landfills. It takes hundreds of years before the plastics biodegrade or break down. Now scientists at California's Stanford University and China's Beihang University say that the mealworm may provide a natural tool to help solve this plastic pollution problem. The American and Chinese researchers found that these tiny worms can actually live on a diet of styrofoam and other forms of polystyrene. The scientists also found that microorganisms in the worms' bellies biodegrade the plastic after processing nutrients from it and produce waste that appears to be safe to use as soil for crops. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Hello, everyone. Good to have you with us today. As we're about to say goodbye to 2015, we thought it'd be nice to hear some of the music, from the traditional to the avant-garde, that many of us like to listen to this time of the year.
On New Year's Eve,
yeah.
I do believe. On New and not a second later, she stay in the mix like a crossfader. It's about to go down, no elevator. Live for the moment, love in the air. She got me feeling like I don't wanna be a player. Real talk, so I don't wanna be unfair. Now watch the apple drop and celebrate the year. Yeah, I see you shining way from over there. And all the
Snoop Dogg is an American rapper and actor, and he's been a mainstay on the music scene for 25 years. Also heard on this cut of Snoop's New Year's Eve is singer-songwriter Marty James.
You and me, we can live, and we can live forever, forever, forever and a day.
Going a little more traditional with Frank Lesser's What Are You Doing New Year's Eve, which hit the top of the charts for the group The Orioles in 1949, contemporary artist A.J. Raphael and Tori Kelly do the honors.
Hey.
So, what are you doing for New Year's and stuff?
Actually, I don't really know yet. What about you?
Oh, yeah, I don't really know what I'm doing yet either. So.
Well, I just kind of wanted to ask. Maybe it's much too early in the game. But I thought I'd ask you just the same. What are you doing New Year's Eve?
Wonder whose arms will hold you good and tight when it's exactly 12 o'clock at night. Welcoming in the
rocker Bruce Springsteen doing the countdown to New Year's in 2009, and other rockers like the Eagles and U2 wrote original songs about New Year's.
Last night I was a happy man, but the way I feel right now, it's gonna be a funky New Year.
And then there's nothing like the New Year's favorite Auld Lang Syne, credited to the works of Scotland's poet Robert Burns, sung here by American superstars of rhythm and blues, Aretha Franklin and Billy Preston, on Billy's 1987 TV show from Detroit.
Acquaintance be forgot and days of old days.
Thank you, Aretha.
Oh, yeah. Billy Preston, he's a great one, too. No longer with us. Great, great, great. Hey, listen, everyone. Thanks for joining us. You're on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope that you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The death of a mother is the greatest misfortune for a young family. When a woman dies in childbirth, the newborn's own chances of survival diminish tenfold. That child and any siblings are less likely to receive health care and to go to school, and the family as a whole is now more likely to suffer economic hardship. Yet every 2 minutes, another mother dies during pregnancy or childbirth. More than half of the deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa. That is why in June 2012, the United States and the government of Norway partnered with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the private sector initiative Merck for Mothers, and the Every Mother Counts campaign to found the Saving Mothers Giving Life initiative. Saving Mothers Giving Life is a 5-year initiative that seeks to reduce maternal mortality by half and improve health in places where women are dying at alarming rates during pregnancy and childbirth. It was initially implemented in 4 districts each in Uganda and Zambia, with a focus on labor, delivery, and the first 48 hours postpartum, the time period in which some 2/3 of maternal deaths and nearly half of infant deaths occur. Early reports indicated that the program was working, so it was expanded in 2014 to an additional 12 districts in Zambia and another 6 districts in Uganda. Now the program has reached its halfway point, and the results are astonishingly good. In Uganda, the institutional maternal mortality rate has fallen by 45% since the beginning of the initiative, and thanks to a strong training and educational campaign, by 41% at the community level. In Zambia, institutional mortality, meaning in a hospital or clinic, has fallen by 53% in the target districts, and nearly 90% of women are now giving birth in a facility compared to 63% at the outset of the initiative. As a result of this success, the partnership is expanding the program to Nigeria, a country that accounts for 14% of the world's maternal deaths and a quarter of the world's newborn deaths, with an initial focus on the southeastern state of Cross River. Surviving childbirth should not be a matter of luck or where you live or how much money you have. Together, we are working to make that a reality.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is for